This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to cover a subject of utmost importance. You know, the recent health care reform bill just foundered in Congress. It crashed and burned. But in my opinion, we may be just rearranging the deck chairs when it comes to reorienting our health care system, because our health care system is headed for disaster if we don't cope with the current epidemics of chronic diseases that threaten to bankrupt the system and debilitate our population. And among the greatest challenges that we face is Alzheimer's disease. In a moment, we'll go over the statistics that underlie the expense and the toll of this deadly epidemic. The book we're talking about today, The Alzheimer's Antidote, great book by today's guest. She's Amy Berger. Amy Berger has a very, very talented researcher and writer. She has a master's degree in human nutrition. She's a certified nutrition specialist, a CNS, as I am. And she has written with great eloquence, mustering all kinds of scientific evidence, about a comprehensive program for staving off mental decline. The book, The Alzheimer's Antidote, Using a Low-Carb, High-Fat Diet to Fight Alzheimer's Disease, Memory Loss, and Cognitive Decline. So without further ado, here's Amy Berger. Amy, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
So let's start with, you know, some grim statistics. I think, you know, basically what's happening is that we're seeing an aging population here in America. The baby boomers are reaching retirement age. They're also reaching an age where many of them are eligible for dementia, cognitive decline. Our healthcare system is in trouble because, well, we can't afford care. So what are some of the numbers?
Well, I don't have them in front of me, but You're exactly right. I mean, now that the population is aging, you know, my dad is 71 and we've got this baby boomer generation, and the expenses associated with this condition are just going to be an economic tsunami, the likes of which we have never seen before. You know, I think it's in the millions now. It's going to be in the billions. Estimates put it by 2050 in the trillions of dollars, trillions with a T. And that's not just the medical care associated with, you know, with treatment and long-term care facilities, but that encompasses the cost to individual families when loved ones and caregivers have to, you know, for example, give up working in order to assume a full-time caregiving role. So not only have they lost their income, but now they face increased healthcare costs of their own from the stress. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's one of the hardest jobs of doing this is the caregiver's role. So it is going to, at the rate we're going, it's going to bankrupt the nation. It's going to bankrupt Medicare. You know, if these things aren't bankrupt already, and it's like you said, this, we are rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, because we don't have a healthcare system. We have a sick care system and we have a disease care system. And we like to jump in after the horse has already gotten out of the barn. You know, this person is already diseased and sick. Now what do we do, instead of really focusing more efforts on the prevention side of the equation?
So we're devoting enormous research dollars to this problem. Clearly, it's recognized that we have to come up with solutions. What's wrong with the current approach that we're taking towards Alzheimer's disease?
What isn't wrong with the current approach? Probably the largest thing wrong is that we are kind of shooting in the dark, looking for treatments to address individual symptoms rather than trying to identify and go after the main root cause of the dysfunction. We have individual drugs to go after these amyloid plaques or various other aspects of this illness that seem to be downstream effects rather than initial driving causes in the pathology. And if we keep on doing that, we're never going to get anywhere because we're not actually dealing with the fundamental problem causing the illness.
Indeed, because we see article after article talking about how the latest new potential drug breakthrough has crashed and burned. This has happened several times because what they seem to be looking for are laser-like drugs that block some sort of biochemical pathway that leads to the deposition of gunk. Their term that they give, the scientific term, is beta amyloid, the gunk that clogs up the brain, that creates tangles, neurofibrillary tangles within the autopsy brains of Alzheimer's patients. But it doesn't seem to work. They're not coming up with a pill that's kind of like a liquid Drano that cleans out the gunk.
Exactly. Well, it's funny, but you're exactly right. I mean, every single drug developed to date to target these plaques has been a failure. But it's been a failure in the same sense that statin cholesterol-lowering medications have been a failure, in that statins do lower cholesterol, they do lower LDL, but does that translate into being protective against heart attack or cardiovascular disease? No, not always. Same thing with these amyloid plaque drugs. These drugs do decrease plaque deposition, but it seems to have no effect on the disease progression. So that should tell us right off the bat that this is the wrong target, or maybe it's just not the most important target. I'm not ready to dismiss it completely, but I'm heartened by the fact that more and more papers are coming out, even in the mainstream media, saying that these drugs are, time and time again, they've had no impact on the disease. So maybe we're chasing the wrong thing here.
So the key, though, is prevention, because it's clear that the beginnings, the seeds of Alzheimer's disease develop maybe 20 years or more before the clinical manifestations occur. It's just that it's subtle, it's sometimes hard to test, and so if we can A, detect it early, or B, undertake a comprehensive metabolic and lifestyle approach, as you outline in the book, maybe, just maybe, we can reduce the toll, correct?
Correct, right. And you hit it right on the head that this disease, it doesn't happen overnight. Nobody wakes up all of a sudden and has severe dementia. The seeds are planted years and in some cases decades ahead. And the main problem going wrong in Alzheimer's disease is that neurons in certain areas of the brain lose the ability to effectively metabolize glucose. They lose the ability to harness energy from glucose. And because of that, They basically starve to death. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but that's, they atrophy and they wither because it's a fuel crisis. They're basically starved for fuel. And they can measure this in people in their 30s and 40s who are at risk for Alzheimer's, whether it's because of a family history or because of other certain risk factors. They can see that these people as young as their 30s and 40s already have a decrease in the rate at which their brain is metabolizing glucose. But at such a young age, they're still compensating. They're not showing clinical signs of the disease, but it's brewing. It's already taking hold, and it's only a matter of time unless they change something about what might be causing that. They are going to develop the condition sometime down the line.
And this is sometimes referred to as type 3 diabetes. I mean, you have your type 1, which is people who require insulin, otherwise they'll die, or blood sugar will skyrocket into the 500-600 range. And then there are the type 2 diabetics, generally a little overweight, and their insulin is actually high. That's not the problem, but they have a lot of insulin resistance. And now a new theory, and I think that this is in line with what you're saying, is that it's kind of like water everywhere, sugar, sugar everywhere, maybe high sugar, but the sugar doesn't get where it needs to go to power the engine, so to speak, or the mitochondria within these avid energy-producing cells.
Exactly. Except water everywhere and not a drop to drink, as they say. I think part of the problem with recognizing more broadly that Alzheimer's is very likely a metabolic and energy problem is that most of these people are not diagnosed diabetics. So the phrase type 3 diabetes, I love it, but it misleads people because they think, well, my blood sugar is normal. You know, my grandfather, his blood sugar is normal. The problem is nobody's looking at insulin. And in many, many of these people, and it's not just Alzheimer's. We could say the same thing about gout, about PCOS, about hypertension, cardiovascular disease, erectile dysfunction. So many of these individuals have normal blood glucose, and even their hemoglobin A1C will be normal, but those glucose metrics are only normal because sky-high insulin is keeping the glucose in check. And in many of these conditions, Alzheimer's included, it's actually the chronically elevated insulin that's driving the problem. And so few doctors are measuring insulin. I mean, and I don't know what you think, but in my opinion, a fasting insulin test should be a routine part of standard blood work, just like fasting glucose. And I hope it's just a matter of time before that is done.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you are a great admirer, according to the book, of Dr. David Perlmutter, who's an integrative neurologist, known to many of our listeners, a frequent contributor here. And his contention is that, no, you don't have to have diabetes to have a higher propensity to dementia and Alzheimer's disease. But he cites studies that suggest that even in the normal range, for every point, we're talking about 0.1 of increase in something called hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of blood sugar control, that even in the normal range, so-called pre-diabetes, that can dramatically hike your risk for neurodegenerative disease.
Right. I mean, studies do show that, like you said, blood glucose high normal, you know, elevated even within the normal range over the long term, they do have a higher risk for Alzheimer's. And I would posit that if they were to measure these people's insulin levels, there would be an even much more strong correlation between elevated insulin and risk for Alzheimer's, because oftentimes the glucose and the A1C will actually be late to rise. They will be the last things to rise after the insulin has been high for so many years and finally the cells become resistant. That's when the glucose starts to rise. I think that's what is causing us to miss this, you know, earlier than we normally could catch it if we were paying more attention to insulin. And I don't mean to say that insulin is the only player here, or that it's, you know, this entire thing is metabolic and there's no other issues feeding into the cycle, but this is the one over which we really have the most control.
Well, when it comes to testing, you mentioned insulin, you mentioned hemoglobin A1C. What are some of the tests that could help us predict risk for dementia? You know, we're doing it with cardiovascular disease. There's very elaborate panels which tell us whether people are prone to heart disease. Is there an equivalent panel of ideal tests that you might recommend? I think you talk about a little bit in the book.
So right now, there's not really a standard specific panel to screen for Alzheimer's, but I would start with anything that indicates insulin resistance. So that would be, you know, glucose, insulin, A1C, definitely triglycerides, HDL, maybe even some of the liver enzymes, because, you know, AST, ALT, some of those liver enzymes will start to elevate before even the glucose moves and the insulin moves. Other than that, there are some specific nutrient deficiencies that definitely exacerbate the problem. I'm not sure if they're causal, but I can't see how they wouldn't be feeding into this somehow, and that would be specifically B12. B12 is extremely important for cognitive function. DHA, the omega-3, you can have a red blood cell analysis done of your, you know, the fatty acid composition of those cells, and that will tell you kind of your omega-3 status. Zinc, Alzheimer's patients tend to be very low in zinc. Other than that, I mean, just general, like, you know, you mentioned inflammation, I don't know that there's a test for like oxidative stress, but really I would start with looking at markers of metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance. So even hypertension, you know, elevated blood pressure with seemingly no explanation for it, that is a clue that there might be an insulin problem there.
Indeed. And a lot has been made of the APOE genetic test. And it's a controversial test because, you know, you better be prepared for a bad result because there are APOE subtypes, the so-called APOE4 subtype. That's pretty much the crack of doom when it comes to susceptibility to Alzheimer's disease. So you write a little bit about that in the book.
Yeah, no, thank you for mentioning it because if I did have to come up with another test that I would recommend, the APOE4 genotype is the strongest known genetic risk factor at this time. I will say, though, that that genotype is not a death sentence because there's, you know, most people with Alzheimer's disease are not E4s, and there's plenty of homozygous E4s, meaning two copies of that E4 gene, who do not develop Alzheimer's. So that E4 by itself is not sufficient to cause this disease, and it's not required, meaning you can absolutely develop this disease without having that status. I think what the A4, the E4 genotype does is increase the susceptibility very highly. So those people need to be especially careful about what they eat and how they live so that they don't sort of trip the switch, so to speak. They don't, you know, they don't push themselves over the threshold into getting this disease. And, you know, we're not 100% certain how to do that. I mean, there's educated speculation and there's things that the science points us toward, but I do think that at least knowing if you do carry that gene is important because that might give you motivation to be a little more serious about your diet.
And there's some controversy about how to handle that because when I first learned about it, and this may have been, you know, a decade ago or so, it was thought that people with the APOE4 gene should be on an ultra low fat diet. Virtually no fat whatsoever. You know, mostly, you know, starches without oils, lots of vegetables, quasi-vegetarian diet because of their inability to handle fats. But there's some new think on that, isn't there, that maybe the culprit could be not so much the fats, but carbs.
Right. There's some people very savvy with the E4 who recommend exactly what you said, kind of a low-carb, high-fat diet, but they do specify that it should be high in the monounsaturated fat and lower in saturated. So the E4s, you know, like you said, the data is a little mixed. You know, we're not really certain of some of these things, but they do seem to do better in terms of their lipid profile and their cardiovascular risk. They seem to do better with less saturated fat. So they would have low to no dairy. You know, maybe they would go a little easier on red meat. Even, you know, red meat is high in monounsaturated fat as well, but they could do a lot more olive oil, avocado, nuts and seeds, that kind of fat. And, you know, fatty seafood, especially, you know, the omega-3s from salmon and other cold fish. But I don't think they are served at all by having a high carbohydrate diet, especially if those carbohydrates are coming from grains.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you see eye to eye with Dr. David Perlmutter, the author of Grain Brain. And what is it about grains that seems to be particularly pernicious for people at risk for Alzheimer's?
I think their glycemic impact and their insulinogenic impact is so much greater than even a starchy food like a potato or, you know, beets or parsnips, some of these starchy underground vegetables. And people vary. I mean, there's more and more information coming out now just how different people's glycemic responses are to the same food. So, like, you know, I can't say that everybody's blood sugar and insulin spikes when they eat wheat bread versus a sweet potato, or that some people are better off eating lentils versus pretzels. You know, it does vary, but I think as a general rule, the carbohydrates, if you're going to eat carbohydrates, they're better off, you know, coming not only from the non-starchy vegetables like lettuce and cucumbers and broccoli, but if you do want something a little starchier, stick to the vegetables more so than the grains.
And what about gluten per se? Because that's been fingered as a potential culprit.
Yeah, I have to say, I am honestly not sure. I don't fall into the camp that thinks gluten is an absolute toxin across the board for all humans. I have read the research on the gut and how, you know, human beings as a rule don't produce the that it affects the zonulin, it affects the tight junctions in the small intestine of everybody. And even so, there are many populations who followed a certain ancestral way of eating for many, you know, hundreds, thousands of years that don't develop these conditions and that are wheat and grain eating populations. So I don't know that it's the gluten per se. I don't think there's anything wrong, of course, with doing a gluten-free diet if you're low carb. But I also think, especially with Alzheimer's patients or anyone who's of advanced age or of a severe disease state, it is so hard, if not impossible, to get them to change their diet. And I think there are some gluten-containing items like very high-fiber, low-carbohydrate crackers, like that type of thing, where maybe it's 2 or 3 grams of carbohydrate for a nice, you know, a large bran cracker or something. And if something like that can help somebody stick to this diet, I would rather have them eat that than eat, if they have a choice between that and a bagel, I mean, I'd rather have them have the bran cracker. So even though it has gluten, you know, but I know, you know, Dr. Perlmutter would disagree. And so I definitely don't want to go again, you know, he is more of an expert than I am. I just don't think gluten is the biggest issue here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, there controversy remains on that subject, but maybe for a certain subset of patients who have either celiac markers or non-celiac gluten intolerance, there can be neurological side effects in some cases.
Right, right. No, people are sensitive to it. And I don't want to, you know, dismiss the issue that gluten could be problematic. And, of course, if you do a gluten-free diet, you're assuming you don't replace it with a lot of these, you know, completely refined gluten-free crackers and bread and cakes and cookies.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
More caloric and just as much sugar and just as much total carbohydrate. You know, if you replace the gluten with something else, it's you're kind of eating less carbohydrate by default if you're going to do a gluten-free diet, if you replace it with not with that other refined carbohydrate.
Some more of a paleo diet, which is a diet relatively free of grains, but permitting dietary carbohydrates from more, shall we say, traditional or ancestral sources of carbohydrates like tubers, you know, root vegetables, and so on.
Exactly right, and those kind of foods. I mean, are, you know, they're very nutritious, they're wholesome foods, and I write in my book that I don't want people to get the idea that a very, very low carbohydrate diet would be required to prevent this, because, you know, I don't. Even if Alzheimer's is a metabolic problem and it's a problem of glucose handling in the brain, I don't think that's caused by lentils and by, you know, yucca root and beets. It's when someone has already progressed to the point where their brain is not metabolizing glucose well, then you probably do need to avoid even those wholesome sources of carbohydrate. But for someone who's metabolically healthy and fit, I don't think you need to necessarily avoid those completely to prevent triggering this illness. That kind of stuff is not what's causing this.
Mm-hmm. But that leads us to the subject of the ketogenic diet, which I want to save for part two. Our listeners know that we divide our podcast into two parts. Today we're talking to Amy Berger. The book is The Alzheimer's Antidote, Using a Low-Carb, High-Fat Diet to Fight Alzheimer's Disease, Memory Loss, and Cognitive Decline. And we're going to talk about solutions and strategies in part two, so stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.